The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Hello, everyone. Today we're going to start off with Oprah's Insiders, Oprah on the Power of Teachers. School was my happy place. It was where I felt nurtured and understood and seen. Hello, insiders. If you'd asked a 10-year-old me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have said a teacher, just like my hero, Mrs. Duncan, at Wharton Elementary in Nashville. I didn't wind up taking that path, but I've never lost the deep respect I have for teachers. I really can't think of a higher calling than to instill confidence and love of learning in young folks. School was my happy place. It was where I felt nurtured and understood and seen. There weren't a whole bunch of adults I felt were interested in me, but that changed when I met Mrs. Duncan in fourth grade. She was the kind of teacher who stayed late and chose books for me to read. Some of you may have seen my reunion with her on an episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show all the way back in 1989. It was honestly an out-of-body experience. I was so happy and overwhelmed to see her that I sobbed until my mascara ran down all over my face. I don't think she'd realized just how much of an influence she'd had on my life, or how grateful I was, and still am to this day. This week we have a piece on the site called The Thing a Teacher Said That Changed My Life. Some of you, and a few Oprah Daily staffers as well, shared words from teachers that made a lasting impact on you. Maybe it was a line of encouragement, or maybe it was a harsh kick in the pants. Whatever it was, it changed your life for the better. This week, I want you to think back to something a teacher said to you that stayed with you. How did it help you shape you or set you on a clear path forward? How can you let those words guide you now? Let me know in the comments below. You know I love reading them. I wish you all a great week. Over in Wellness, how hormone replacement could help prevent Alzheimer's. A new study, including a sample of 6 million women, suggests that midlife HRT could substantially cut the risk of developing the disease. Hormone replacement therapy, HRT, may have a protective effect against Alzheimer's disease and dementia, according to new research. In June, frightening headlines followed a Danish study that suggested HRT could be linked to an increased risk of developing dementia. But that study focused solely on the use of synthetic hormones in around 62,000 women. This latest study includes the use of more commonly used bioidentical hormones, as well as estrogen-only therapy, and encompassed over 6 million women in different countries. Researchers at Weill, and that's W-E-I-L-L, or Well, Cornell Medicine, found that women who took hormones to treat midlife menopause symptoms were significantly less likely to develop dementia or Alzheimer's later in life. Estrogen-only therapy was associated with a 32% reduced risk of developing the disease, while estrogen progesterone therapy showed a 23% reduced risk. The study, which was published in the journal Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience, is a meta-analysis of existing clinical trials and observational studies. The stats on Alzheimer's are stark. A 45 to 50-year-old woman has an estimated lifetime risk for developing the disease of 1 in 5, while a man of the same age's risk is just 1 in 10. Researchers have long theorized that estrogen has a protective effect on the brain, and that the menopausal dearth of this hormone could be to blame for the higher number of women who develop the disease. We think of estrogen as a sex hormone, but that's misleading, says the study's senior author, Lisa Mosconi, Ph.D., director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program and of the Women's Brain Initiative, and an associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Cornell Medicine. Estrogen and progesterone were discovered back in the 1930s by people studying reproduction. They labeled them sex hormones without realizing that these hormones had many other functionalities that had nothing to do with having kids. One vital role in neurological estrogen is actually called the master regulator on women's brain health. It's like an orchestra conductor for the brain, explains Mosconi. It's important for a number of functions. It protects the brain, it supports the immune system, and it supports neuroplasticity, which is the ability to recover from damage and strengthen neuronal connections. It also supports neuronal energy at a cellular level. Currently, estrogen-only therapy is recommended for women who have undergone a hysterectomy because it comes with a heightened risk of uterine cancer. The majority of women using HRT take combined estrogen and progesterone, which minimizes the cancer risk, but also seems to blunt the Alzheimer's preventative effects. Although combined estrogen and progesterone, HRT therapy still showed a reduced overall risk of developing Alzheimer's, 23%. This was less consistent across the studies analyzed. Most showed a protective effect, some, like the recent Danish study, showed a harmful effect, and some showed no effect at all. Mosconi believes that this negative effect could potentially be due to the use of synthetic progesterone, known as progestins, in some of the older studies analyzed. These days, bioidentical progesterone is more commonly used in HRT. We know that some synthetic versions actually had a negative impact on the heart and vascular system, she explains. They increased inflammation, so that could be a reason why some of the studies showed negative effects. Another vital takeaway, to reap these protective effects, treatment should begin in midlife. Women taking estrogen-only HRT at age 65 and above showed a similar risk factor as their non-HRT-taking peers. Whereas estrogen plus progesterone was associated with a trend toward increased risk. Mosconi's previous work had already shown that, rather than being a disease of old age, dementia is actually a disease of midlife with symptoms that appear late in life. She and her team are now at work on clinical trials in search of more conclusive data. Because Alzheimer's risk is seeded in midlife, but the symptoms often develop later in life, a clinical trial spanning this time frame, 20 to 30 years, would be challenging. For this reason, Mosconi's team will study the effect of estrogen therapy on Alzheimer's biomarkers, clues that the disease is likely to develop, that begin to appear during middle age. This is another article in Wellness. Yes, you can care for your aging parents from afar. Here's a guide to keeping them safe while you hold on to your sanity. When I had my son 22 years ago, my mom moved across the country to live near us. My daughter was born 2 years later, and having a grandma just a mile away was a huge help with the two young kids. We had an eager babysitter for date nights. My mom could pop over to the grocery store or library for me, and she was always happy to pick up a sick kid from school or do a last-minute drive to baseball practice or dance lessons. Having her woven thread by thread into our daily routine made life richer for all three generations. The kids had an additional adoring and supporting of adult they could count on. My mom got joy and a sense of purpose from being an indispensable part of our lives. And as for me, well, there's nothing like having kids yourself to realize how important family is. A few years ago, around age 80, my mom started slowing down. Her memory became spotty, her balance wobbly. She was still independent, but my brother and I worried. Would she fall down the stairs in her apartment? Should she still be driving? Was she on top of her medications? The tables had turned. The person who had cared for me and my brother from birth through launch had been an involved caregiver for her grandchildren, was beginning to need care herself. It was a bittersweet time. My kids were heading off to college while my brother and I were talking with our mom about her next step. For various logistical reasons, we figured out that it made sense for her to move into an assisted living facility near my brother. So instead of being a mile from me, she would be several hours away. I was just coming to terms with the fact that my mom needed support, and now I would have to figure out how often to offer it from a distance. And she wasn't the only one who would need support. She would be very near my brother, so he would become her local caregiver. I needed to support him, too. Here are some things we've figured out since then, plus some smart, thoughtful tips from pros. Do some gentle detective work. The first step in caregiving from afar is figuring out what your parents need to be safe and well. If they live around the corner, you'll likely know when driving at night has gotten difficult or that they're becoming forgetful. When they're across the country, you might not. What's more, if you ask how you can help, they may not be 100% upfront. It's hard for older adults to admit to themselves and to others, especially their children, when routine activities are challenging. One subtle way to keep up is to connect with their existing network. If you don't know their friends or neighbors, reach out, introduce yourself, and exchange numbers. Ask them to contact you if they noticed any safety or health concerns. If your parents are managing well, that may be all the help and reassurance you need. If you need more intel, in-person visits are very revealing, says Aaron Blight, author of When Caregiving Calls and founder of Caregiving Kinetics, a consulting company. Linda Abbott, author of The Conscious Caregiver, agrees. It's easy for your loved ones to appear to be functioning normally if you're having a phone call here and there. For a true assessment, go and spend a long weekend and conduct what Abbott calls the cottage cheese test. Peek in the fridge. Do they seem to be shopping and eating well, or are foods past their prime or inadequate? Similarly, a stack of mail and bills could indicate difficulty managing finances. Other things to check: how they handle transportation, housekeeping, taking medication, and shopping for essentials. Can your parent do those things independently and safely? To find out, you have to walk a little bit of a balancing act, says Blight. Be observant and ask questions without being overbearing. Older adults might be a bit afraid of what might happen if they admit they're not able to manage their affairs like they used to. Once you understand the situation, you can figure out how to help from a distance. That might look like setting up bills on auto pay and ordering groceries online for them every week or two. You can also arrange non-medical home care, perhaps booking a few hours a week of help with cleaning and laundry, meal prep and errands, or more assistance, medical or otherwise, at home or in a facility as needed. If you're not sure how to proceed after your own sleuthing, a home care company or elder care consultant can audit your parents' living situation. My brother and I did this before our mom moved, and it was illuminating. Our consultant told us to remove the throw rugs from her place, major tripping hazard, and add a grab bar by the step down into her kitchen. But long term, she advised our mom would be much safer someplace without any steps. Her questions and our mom's answers helped us realize where she was faltering. Stay in touch regularly and randomly. It's hard to understand the significance of reaching out to your parents, says Blight. So when you're not close by, figure out the best way to stay connected. A routine schedule is great, says Blight. Your loved one can look forward to a call every Sunday afternoon. They know what to expect, and that allows you to build it into your schedule so it's predictable. But spontaneous calls are wonderful as well. Every family is different. I have one friend who stops whatever she's doing at 9 p.m. to give her dad a quick call. My mom isn't a big phone chatter, so I recently started texting her a picture a day showing something happening in my life. TBH, it's usually of my dog, but my life isn't that interesting. Some families prop an iPad on the table so their parents can join for dinner. Another friend has a weekly family Zoom call on Sundays at 11 ET, a time everyone can swing given that she's in New York and her siblings are in California and the UK. And when you can, visit in person, Abbott says. Don't just run errands and organize. It's important to have quality time. Cherish your time together. Lee Woodruff, a journalist and author, became a caregiver in 2006 after her husband, news anchor Bob Woodruff, was injured in an explosion in Iraq. More recently, she was a long-distance caregiver for her mother, who passed away earlier this year. She made a point to visit regularly and to make sure she did more than just cross things off a to-do list, though knocking off a few things each visit is helpful too. Even if I was taking her to a doctor's appointment, I would build in time, Woodruff says. She liked to be in her little chair in the sun in her room. I'm so grateful for just sitting and talking to her. Some of the best conversations we had were in that little part of her life. I got as much out of those moments as she did. I could make up for being an eye-rolling teenager. Divide and conquer, and thank each other. Often one sibling shoulders more of the caregiving load, particularly if they're closest geographically and or emotionally. The key to keeping the peace is, you guessed it, communication. The first thing is just having the siblings get together and say, look, our mom or dad or both are facing these challenges, says Blight. Let's work collaboratively to help them and agree that we're not going to let this drive a wedge into our relationship and that we're going to be a team. A sure path to victory. Play to your strengths. The geographically closest caregiver will be the default for many tasks, but plenty can be done long distance. The sibling who is best with numbers can handle bills and other financial matters. The most techie sib can be the IT help desk, taking calls about the computer, iPad, and the remote control. That's not just my mom, is it? Another can take on ordering anything that's needed, whether that's groceries or toiletries on a regular basis, or a new bathing suit, or walking shoes right before you all go on vacation. In my family, my brother is the go-to, but I do what I can. Pay bills, make appointments, follow up with doctors, or figure out prescriptions or insurance, even if the task almost always involves being on hold with customer service for a very long time. I'm happy when my brother delegates to me because I know it takes something off his plate. Indeed, Woodruff reminds us to remember the gratitude piece for the person who's on the front lines. She would sometimes send flowers or a card out of the blue to her hometown sister to show she acknowledged everything she was doing. On the flip side, Woodruff warns against being tone-deaf. Don't call your sister to say you're enjoying a glass of wine on your deck on a Friday afternoon if she's likely exhausted at the end of a long week of caregiving with more of the same in store for the weekend. Know your audience. Be respectful. Woodruff's family came up with another ground rule when it comes to the small stuff. If you aren't the person on the front lines, and you aren't there, then you really don't have a right to complain. And no matter what you think of the sibling who is doing the day-to-day, unless there's something egregiously wrong, you need to hold your tongue most of the time. My brother and I haven't had to test that one out, but it sounds fair to me. This is no time to be controlling or micromanaging. Instead, just thank each other for all that you're doing so you can look back on these years with no regrets. And here are some helpful resources for long-distance caregiving. Aging Life Care Association is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting healthy aging for their clients, families, and communities. They take a holistic approach to caring for older adults or those who face ongoing health challenges. The next one is Carely. Is a social caregiving application for families to coordinate care, such as tracking appointments, finding medications, and connecting your family to local support communities. The next one is LOTSA Helping Hand, is a website and mobile app used to quickly and easily organize help, such as meals, rides, and appointment coordination for a loved one in need. The next one is Home Instead, is a home care service for older adults. Whether it's senior care services, personal support services, transitional care, or more, their caregivers are thoroughly screened and professionally trained to fit your loved one's needs. And the last one is I'm Dead, Now What? Is a no-nonsense, not depressingly morbid planner for organizing vital details like healthcare info, contact information, legal matters, financial affairs, and more. And it's an OFT 2023 pick. Another article in Wellness. Is humming the new walking? Here's how this most pleasurable act is a natural heart booster, anxiety soother, pain reliever, and sleep improver. Certain wellness endeavors call for daring, grit, or tenacity. But one of the most reliably enriching, stress-reducing practices around is just plain pleasant. humming. It's free, it's easy, and truly almost anyone can do it. Research has shown that the simple act of humming, from show tunes to improvised non-melodies, improves health conditions and contributes to an overall sense of sunny well-being. Here are five reasons to hum a few bars. Number one, it calms the nervous system. One of the most intriguing effects of humming is that by bringing that self-soothing vibration into the body, you trigger a cascade of positive physiological shifts. Most important, it stimulates the vagus nerve, which governs the body's parasympathetic rest and digest state, lowering anxiety and releasing potent relaxing hormones. A resilient vagus nerve, one with good vagal tone, a stress index measured indirectly through heart rate variability, helps us regulate our emotions. Researchers are studying the effects vagal stimulation can have in treating anxiety and depression. In yoga, the practice of humming is called Brahmari, or bee breath, explains Carla Strangenberg, director of Jaya Yoga Center in Brooklyn. Brahmari pranayama is a fantastic self-generated way to regain one's agency, she notes. When focused inwardly, we are no longer chasing externals. Strangenberg begins and ends each class by chanting Om, initiating that humming vibration with a long trailing sound. To experience the relaxing release of bee breath, sit comfortably and allow for a few natural breaths to pass as you shift perspective, she suggests. Let go of any tension in the body. Then, on an exhale, create a humming, buzzing sound at the back of your throat. For a deeper sensation, use your index and middle fingers to gently depress the tragus, the small triangle of cartilage just outside the ear canal. You're essentially plugging your ears, which amplifies the internal buzzing. Number two, it boosts cardiovascular health. Researchers have found that when we hum, the amount of nitric oxide in our nasal passages increases 15-fold, which is significant because nitric oxide is a natural vasodilator, widening constricted blood vessels and decreasing stress on the heart and the vascular system. A wider, more open vasculature can better deliver oxygen and nutrient-rich blood to the organs and tissues, which in turn could potentially reduce inflammation and support healing the whole body over. Research has also shown it can prevent sinus infections. Why not make a habit of humming every time you step outside? Support your body with a big, bold breath of fresh air and a nitric oxide super boost as you hum a tune through the exhale. Using the mnemonic of passing through a doorway will help you create this healthy routine. Think of it as your theme song. Number three, it relieves pain. Conscious humming experts Jonathan and Andy Goldman, co-authors of The Humming Effect, believe the renaissance of humming can help reduce pain, especially when the sound vibration is directed towards discomfort in the body. Frequency plus intent equals healing, they write, noting that intent is as important as the actual sound you are creating. For example, you might have a pain in a certain part of your body and perhaps envision a warm golden light radiating healing energy into that area as you hum, they suggest. Or you might visualize encoding all your cells with vitality, dissipating any imbalanced energy. To practice conscious humming, they recommend relaxing for 5 minutes to clarify your intention, then humming for about 5 minutes, then grounding for 5 minutes, noticing any changes in your body and becoming present to the moment and your surroundings again. You can also try it in the moment, heading into a difficult conversation or intense meeting. Quietly hum your way through the elevator ride and down the hall. Number four, it lulls you to sleep. Humming and lullabies go hand in hand, yet it's still surprising to learn that humming actually causes the body to release the hormone melatonin, which tells our bodies it's time to sleep. So add it to your sleep stack, beginning in the hour before you turn in. Hum while you journal, shower, or tie up loose ends around your home. You don't have to carry a tune to benefit. Let it be easy and light, not an added stress. Preparing yourself for sleep in this way should feel soothing and comforting. Number 5. It deeply grounds you. Despite all its tangible advantages, the intrinsic value of humming just because it feels good, can't be dismissed. Physiological benefits aside, it's a total meditation, so be present with it, not trying to do it for the results, suggests Jean McClendon, a master of the Alexander technique who teaches voice at Columbia University. McClendon considers humming a foundational practice, not only for rooting one's voice in the diaphragm, essentially for singing and acting students, but also as a pathway to expressing our essential life force. Honoring that potential, her method never forces a hum. Instead, she suggests allowing the sound to arise authentically from within. Just sit anchored and supported in a chair, hands low in the lap, and then allow the sound to lift by feeling a bit of gentle pressure from the inside. Try a rhythmic hum, in and up, which can sound a bit like a puppy whimpering with pure earnestness. Then draw out the as you might when tasting something delicious. But keep it experimental, in tune with your own inner explorations. Never focus on the idea of sound, McClendon says. You're really coming to a process rather than an end. Humming creates the freedom to get out of the head and be one with the self, she adds wisely. It's holistic. You come to the ground of your being. In other words, it's a vibration of discovery. Over in relationships, yes, cuffing season is a real thing. Nope, it's not in your head. Being single has innumerable benefits, but as the holidays near, have you found yourself wanting to spend your evenings with a pair of fuzzy socks and a newly loved one? Bonus, if a cheesy Christmas movie is involved. That intrinsic desire to hibernate with someone in the winter is what cuffing season is all about. As the days grow shorter and more frigid, there's a seemingly natural pull toward wanting to couple up and swipe right on someone you wouldn't normally be drawn to. Are you feeling it? Here's what to know before cuffing season commences. Cuffing season is basically when content singles suddenly pair up. Cuffing season occurs as soon as the weather gets colder, and single folks are extra motivated to meet someone, says Stephanie Maria Penier. Penea, and that's P-E with an accent mark over the N-A. A psychotherapist based in Brooklyn, New York, it's largely attributed to the temperature dropping and the influx of holidays, which makes people eager to have a sweetheart to cuddle with by the fire, to kiss at midnight on New Year's, to take the office Christmas party, to take to the office Christmas party, etc. The extra origins of the term cuffing is not clear. A popular opinion is that the term cuff originated from African-American slang as a verb for hook up. Others believe that it was first used by college newspapers in 2011, gaining popularity in social media in the fall of 2013. Cuffing season starts in the fall. According to Urban Dictionary, which first added the term in 2011, cuffing season takes place during the fall and winter months. Typically, it starts at the end of the fall and ends before springtime. Although this is, of course, mostly anecdotal, and there are exceptions, people tend to pair up before Thanksgiving and break up after Valentine's Day. According to older data from Facebook, people are often entering in a relationship between October and February, then changing their status back to single in March. With the rise of dating apps like Tinder, Hinge, and Bumble, the phenomenon of cuffing has increased. And really, it makes sense. Cuffing season happens like a perfect storm, says Krista Lynn Landolfi, a quality of life coach based in Los Angeles, who cites self-care as a foundational aspect of her service. The cold weather creates a desire for someone to hold you and keep you warm. Society tells us holidays are meant to be shared with a mate. Knowing you can get the winter blues triggers the idea that being in a relationship will bring you more joy. All of this contributes to you feeling that you would rather Netflix and chill with a partner, even someone who's just okay and in no way your ideal. It can be beneficial. If both parties are clear about their desires and the fact that they view the relationship as a temporary one, this can take some pressure off, says Pena. Who knows? You might be more open to seeing what develops when you're not trying to force something that isn't there, she adds. But cuffing season can also be hurtful. A common pitfall is that you might be being less discerning and settle for someone you normally wouldn't be compatible with, says Pena. You could possibly ignore red flags or overlook things that would normally be deal breakers for the sake of staying together for those lonely Sunday nights. You should also be cautious if your casual cuffer is all of a sudden very enthusiastic about introducing you to their family, says Pena, as it could signify they're looking for something more serious and long-term than a cozy seasonal fling. You don't have to take part. Don't forget, being single during the holidays can be fun, too. You can meet new people and save money by not having to buy extra presents, and you don't have to attend your temporary significant other's parties. But if you find yourself having a particularly difficult time during cuffing season, talking in therapy about your relationship or loneliness issues might be a good way to heal, Pena says. Therapy can be useful for someone who is motivated to feel more joy in their life, she continues. Of course, even if it seems like everyone else on the planet, or at least on Instagram, is in a fresh relationship, you can still find friends who haven't found themselves newly coupled. And remember, a good book can always keep you company until spring. Over in Work and Money. A social entrepreneur is born at age 67. An Vu Sawyer's story, which took her from refugee camps in the aftermath of the Vietnam War to Harvard Square, might just renew your faith in the American dream. With an ever-widening income gap, the very idea of the American dream seems more elusive than ever. Yet every once in a while we hear a story that reminds us of the strength of its tenets and social mobility, political and religious freedom, and yes, the pursuit of happiness. Author, speaker, and Harvard Advanced Leadership Initiative Fellow Ann Vu Sawyer represents a more nuanced version of the rags-to-riches tale. Vu Sawyer was born Vu Thai Nhoap An in Vietnam in 1955, and her story begins on April 30, 1975, when she and her mother, father, and three siblings were evacuated during the fall of Saigon, and ends with her in her late 60s going to Harvard and becoming a successful social entrepreneur. Like so many political refugees, Vu Sawyer had to start from nothing when she came to America after abandoning her medical school studies in Vietnam, as the family headed into an unknown future with only memories of a life left behind. They were unable to speak English, and their journey took them to five refugee camps, including Wake Island, Guam, and Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. "I was angry at God for a long time. I couldn't understand why this was happening to my family," Vu Sawyer said about her early days in the U.S., when her only solace was in reading the Bible and going to church. Sponsored by a Christian Reformed church in Oak Brook, Illinois, Vu Sawyer and her family were sheltered for several months by a parishioner who had an available rental unit. While the church could pay several months of rent, the family needed to figure out how to take care of themselves and moving forward. While searching for work, they devoted their time to studying English and learning everything they could about American culture. They cooked Vietnamese food for their sponsors as a gesture of gratitude. Shortly thereafter, her mother, a former teacher and principal, got a job as a dishwasher, and her father became a garbage collector for a watch company. As the eldest child, Vu Sawyer was compelled to pitch in with a job at a local hospital to help provide for the family. It seemed that her dreams of pursuing a higher education faded with the grind of assimilation and survival. During that time, she was consumed by fear and sadness that she would spend her life just trying to stay afloat rather than being able to pursue any of her dreams. That is, until a couple from the church found a way to help her enroll in a Wheaton college. She spent two terms there perfecting her English. It was there that she spotted a young man with long hair, fanciful clothes, and an earring. She says it was more or less love at first sight, and it took her just a few weeks to fully fall for this exotic American man named Philip, who would become her husband. Spoiler alert, they've been married nearly half a century. Her life would take another fateful turn when her sponsor family helped Boo Sawyer and two of her siblings get full scholarships at Calvin College, a Christian reform school in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that offered support to several dozen Vietnamese refugee students. She graduated with a degree in mathematics and economics, and two of her brothers ultimately became engineers. Her youngest brother became an OBGYN and has a thriving practice in California. Vu Sawyer and her husband began their married life like many young couples. They had three children. She became a working mother, and they moved to Colorado Springs, where they lived for 13 years. She worked as a program director there for a nonprofit that developed healthcare and educational projects in the U.S. and Vietnam. It was when they moved to Worcester, Massachusetts for her husband's work that she got a job as the executive director of the Southeast Asian Coalition of Central Massachusetts, SEACMA, where she spent nearly 10 years leading the organization's missions to support immigrants, refugees, and low-income residents. The goal of the organization was to help people integrate into American society through education and employment while maintaining their cultural identity. It was meaningful work and gave her an inkling of the community she wanted to serve. But after nearly four decades of juggling full-time work and raising a family, she had a sort of epiphany, or as she describes, something happened in her early 60s. "Because of all of my family responsibilities, like many women, I put aside my own big dreams," she says. "Now that the kids were independent and all out of college, I was ready to pursue those dreams with abandon." While still working in Worcester, Vu Sawyer and her husband moved to Boston and started their next chapter. She began to focus on how she might create greater impact and foster a broader refugee community. Vu Sawyer also underwent a spiritual awakening. While her Christian religion had provided necessary emotional, spiritual scaffoldings, especially during those lonely early years in America, she made the decision to leave the church and forged a spiritual practice of her own. "God knows what is in my heart and knew what I was looking for, a new community of people, as I set out on a reimagined journey," she says. In Boston, one of her volunteer commitments was working with kids who were immigrants and refugees and were first-generation high school graduates, which was a logical segue from her previous post. Her goal was to help them realize that they, too, could create optionality and the potential for greater fulfillment by going to college. It wasn't until she got to talking with the students that she understood that language and academics weren't the only barrier to entry for these kids. "They all told me that they were too poor and felt that they wouldn't fit in at college based on their family background," she says. Listening to those kids reminded her not only of her younger self, but also of the real and imagined obstacles that dogged her into adulthood. "I made a deal with them. If they would apply to college, then I would apply to a graduate program at the same time," she says. "I really didn't know what I was saying, but that was what I put out as a challenge. Ultimately, all 20 kids applied to college, and all of them were accepted." Amazingly, Vu Sawyer lived up to her promise and applied for an MBA at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. At 66, she assumed she would never be accepted, until she was. "I was excited, but I had no idea how I was going to pay for this program, and we didn't have a lot of money," she said. "I almost had to sell our house twice and ultimately refinanced, but I found a scholarship. And for the final closure of this virtuous circle, when some of her students learned about her financial situation, they helped raise money to complete her tuition payments." As a graduate student, she started piecing together all aspects of her own immigrant experience and her nonprofit work and thinking about a business plan that would be focused on social impact, namely on the immigrant and refugee communities. "It was a big risk, but I wanted to dare to live the American dream again, and none of us will die for trying something new," she says. "Besides, at my age, I still have a lot to learn, and I'm going to show up," she said. After her graduation from MIT in 2020, Vu Sawyer began to plan her departure from SEACMA to focus on her new social impact business venture. Her company, which she called On55 after her name and birth year, is in many ways a natural extension of her own story. Engaging immigrant and refugee communities in producing a line of sustainable clothing for women over 40 that's both affordable and stylish. While working on the plan, a friend reached out and suggested that she apply to the Harvard Advanced Leadership Initiative, a program that would allow her to develop her business idea more fully. She was not only accepted to the program, but also received a scholarship. The year-long Harvard program is specifically designed to help individuals fine-tune a project in its early stages of development, so that is all but guaranteed to create meaningful social impact. While still in school, Voy Sawyer received a grant from the Massachusetts Growth Capital Corporation, a state agency that contributes $2 for every dollar she raises. A grant from the Boston Mayor's Office has allowed her to secure a 3-year lease for her business. Her plan for production is to start in Boston, then relocate to Vietnam once everything is established. She's already vetted a refugee community in northern Thailand that will focus on creating labels for her clothing. Women in these communities have no ability to have machinery, so they have perfected both embroidering and weaving techniques, she says. And while a machine can take 3 seconds to create a label, doing it by hand can take 4 hours or more, according to Vu Sawyer. We plan to pay these women $4 to $6 per label in their traditional manner, which in many parts of the world would be a day's wage. Sawyer explains that there are 3 generations of refugees in some places in the world. Her goal is to help them earn a living to find their own path to a better future. She also plans to help train teachers to teach English as another way to break the poverty cycle inherent in being a refugee with no education. We've already set up cooperatives without borders to help our label-making teams create co-ops, she says. I want On 55 to ultimately be an employee-owned, sustainable company, helping to lift women out of poverty with an economic model that we can take around the world. The Harvard program will end later this year. Meanwhile, as Vu Sawyer continues to line up grants and investors, she is poised to produce her first line of ready-to-wear clothing in a soft launch at the end of this year at on55.com. As she approaches 70, an age when so many others plot their retirement, Vu Sawyer is just getting started. After a decades-long journey that has taken her from refugee camps to Harvard, Vu Sawyer plans to spend the rest of her life as an entrepreneur committed to supporting women and the immigrant and refugee communities in a very direct way. I love this country and its ideals and opportunities, she said. I think God led me to MIT and then to Harvard to prepare me for this work. Okay, we're over in culture and news. Tyler Perry's View interview comes to a halt after he hears Sarah Haynes' beautiful comments. Sarah said something about Tyler's mother that moved him to tears. Tyler Perry doesn't often get emotional on national television, so when he did, fans couldn't help but be so touched by it. The media mogul appeared on a November 7th taping of The View to promote his upcoming documentary, Maxine's Baby, The Tyler Perry Story, which tells the story of how he became the person he is today. As he discussed the project with Sarah Haynes and her co-hosts Whoopi Goldberg, Joy Bier, Sunny Hostin, and Alicia Farah Griffin, Haynes told him how moved she was after watching it. What's more, she let Perry know that his late mother Maxine Perry's presence could be felt throughout. I always say there are people who carry a light, she told him. I look at you, and I think you're not someone who was left to teach the words. You were there to live the words and show by example. This film I will watch every time I need to find my own power, and I wanted to run laps when I got done. When I met Maxine through all of it, I didn't know her, but the film shows just how much you endured as a child. After hearing Haynes's words, Perry couldn't help but to start crying over her high praise for his mother. With tears pouring down his face, he stopped the interview to share how much hearing Sarah's words meant to him. Okay, wait a minute, he emotionally interjected. You met my mother through it? That's, wow. Wow. Thank you. Oh my God. To say that you met her through that, it takes me somewhere. Because this woman endured so much pain and she didn't have some legacy. But she had me. To say that I was able to introduce her to you, you got me there. Thank you for that. As folks witnessed this moment between Perry and Haynes on the air, people were completely moved. This led many to praise the two for being so vulnerable about something so personal. Thank you, Sarah, for the beautiful moment with Tyler, one person wrote on YouTube. Sarah shared such a beautiful and powerful compliment to Tyler, and his response was touching. "I love this lady," another declared. "One of the most beautiful moments in the history of this show ever," a different follower added. Needless to say, our heartstrings were definitely pulled. Still in culture and news, The View host Whoopi Goldberg's comments about Britney Spears caused a big reaction from fans. The Grammy Award winner's book, The Woman in Me, struck a chord with the longtime host. Britney Spears' memoir, The Woman in Me, may have only hit bookshelves on October 24th, but the singer's complex and moving story has already captured audiences worldwide. One person who was particularly touched upon reading the book was Whoopi Goldberg, and she's using her platform to speak out about it. During a November 3rd taping of The View, fans saw Goldberg sit with Sarah Haynes, Sonny Hostin, Alyssa Farah Griffin, and Anna Navarro to discuss Britney's book. Whoopi was quick to note how many people, herself included, are now seeing the pop star in a different light after learning about her life story and all that she's been through. Britney Spears' memoir is a huge bestseller, and I can tell you I listened to it. It's magnificent, she praised the Grammy Award winner. It's funny, it's moving, it's just terrific, and it paints a much different portrait than the way she's been portrayed in the media. I think it will change a lot of people's minds. As Haynes, Griffin, Hostin, and Navarro share their opinions about how the media impacted Spears' journey in music, Goldberg shared a particular moment in the memoir that left her feeling angry by what the singer experienced. In the book, Goldberg says there's a moment Spears discusses how she received feedback after a performance, and how the people around her essentially showed her the footage to get a negative reaction from the singer. This is what we do in the media. We make judgment calls, and then they stick because our words have weight. So until we walk a mile in those shoes, maybe we have to be a little less judgmental, you know? When viewers saw how much reading The Woman in Me affected Whoopi, they immediately went online to voice how much they agreed with the TV host's public declaration for Britney. Whoopi is great. I listened to it, and it definitely sheds light on why Britney is who she is now. The woman has been through a lot, one person wrote on YouTube. Couldn't agree more, Whoopi, another added on Instagram. Whoopi hit the nail on the head at the end, so until we walk a mile in folks' shoes, maybe we should be a little less judgmental, another wrote on YouTube. Well, it looks like Goldberg wasn't the only one who felt a certain way about Spears' new work. The Woman in Me is now at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. In TV and movies, in the new Hulu series Black Cake, A Mother's Secrets Send Shockwaves Through a Family, creator Marissa Jo Sirar gave us a sneak peek into the drama. It's impossible to fathom how heavy your family's baggage is until someone painstakingly excavates it. In the new series Black Cake, premiering on Hulu on November 1st, main character Eleanor Bennett comes clean to her children in audio recordings they listened to after her death, recounting a lifetime spent running from her home in the Caribbean and from her real name and identity in order to survive. Laced with jaw-dropping moments, the show spans multiple generations and countries, including Jamaica, England, and Scotland. The confection in the series' name presents both the hope and horror to come as the story unfolds. As Bennett narrates in Episode 1, Black Cake evolved from the British plum pudding that colonizers brought to the West Indies. It reflects the marriage of cultures, mine and yours. Oprah served as an executive producer on the series, which showrunner and creator Marissa Jo Sirar, and that's C-E-R-A-R, adapted from the New York Times best-selling novel by Charmaine Wilkinson. Sirar, who is biracial, instantly recognized parts of her own experience in the story's Jamaican-Chinese main character. "I wanted to protect the book and do it justice," she says. We talked to her about bringing this family saga to the screen and how sharing family secrets can snuff out shame. How did you get involved in this project? I read the manuscript of the book before it was ever published. The moment I finished the last word on the last page, I called my agent and said, "This is a series. It's not a movie. Don't let anybody tell you this. There's too much going on here, too many characters." So much of it relates to my personal experience. I am biracial. I am the mother of a biracial daughter. I have a very unique, blended, multicultural family, and I wanted to see black, brown, Asian people at the forefront of a story that wasn't about the civil rights movement, slavery, or oppression. I wanted to do a series with the same level of artistry as The Queen's Gambit, Little Fires Everywhere, and The Handmaid's Tale, but with women of color at the forefront rather than supporting. And I wanted to tell a story I wasn't seeing, a different black experience, a black immigrant experience, a young, queer, black experience, and an international black story. I guess I wouldn't even say black story, an international multicultural story. How does the story mirror your own experiences? I'm half black, half white, and grew up in a very small rural town, so I identified with Covey, Bennett's birth name, immediately trying to figure out who she was as a teenage girl and where she belonged. And I think all of us, whether we're biracial, black, Asian, white, whatever, we can relate to that coming of age. Her relationship with Bunny, to me, is the soul of the series. Two young black girls who truly love each other would sacrifice anything for each other, and there's not a competition, and it's really true love. I just haven't seen that on TV. And I'm adopted, so I have white parents. Covey's father is a Chinese immigrant in Jamaica. She doesn't necessarily look like him, and her mother isn't in her daily life, so she's trying to hold on to her culture and actually find out what her culture is without having that mother figure. I have both my parents. I love them. They're amazing. But when you don't see yourself as a kid, it's difficult. So I really related to that with Covey's story, struggling to find yourself, love yourself. Obviously, the stakes are so much higher because she's running for her life. But she's also trying to find herself and embrace an identity that feels true and safe. I absolutely related to that. And I'm a mom now of a mixed-race child who looks like me but doesn't. She looks like a white person. So I'm sure she's going to have her own connection to the material when she's old enough to watch this. What can the show teach us about the power of revealing family secrets, even if they were once crucial for survival? One of the things that spoke to me after reading the book, and then I spoke to my writer's room, when I brought a team on to write episodes 2 through 8, was shame. Shame keeps people apart. Shame keeps people from telling the truth. It keeps people running. It keeps people unsettled. And releasing ourselves from this burden of shame, which is woven into these family secrets, is very, very hard. But if we can muster up the courage, freedom is possible. Freedom from the secrets that eat away at us, and freedom from the shame that keeps us from being our truest selves. It's also about honoring your cultural roots. Why is that so important? When we know where we come from, and by we, I mean our ancestors, our parents, our country, when we understand what got us to where we are today, I believe we have a better understanding of why we do some of the things we do, of why we're triggered by some things, and of why it's hard for us to get close to people. It gives us an opportunity to right some of the wrongs of the past, or at the very least, heal from them and try to do better. Sometimes it's too late to try to do better with loved ones you're struggling with. But for the next generation or your next relationship or for your child or your niece or nephew, I think if we know why and where we come from, it'll help us do better and hopefully make our futures a little bit lighter, a little bit easier, and a little bit truer. What else do you want viewers to take from the show? I think black women are often portrayed as superheroes who don't break, don't cry. We have to be so strong and have this wall up, but that's definitely not me. I am the most vulnerable open wound, and I felt it was important to show these women and girls who are strong also allow themselves to be vulnerable. Another way of breaking cycles and overcoming shame is allowing yourself to be vulnerable. I hope that's something the audience relates to and embraces. Parts of this article were edited due to time. In culture and news, Katy Perry in Orlando Bloom's toddler daughter cheers on her mom at final Las Vegas concert. Katy Perry had a very special guest in the audience as she wrapped up her Las Vegas residency on Saturday night, her toddler daughter. "Daisy, I love you so much," Perry said from the stage. "You're my best friend, and I'm so glad you're here." The three-year-old was joined by her dad, Perry's longtime partner, actor Orlando Bloom. The little girl looked adorable in a Minnie Mouse-inspired red dress with white polka dots, plus a pair of pink headphones to protect her ears. "I'm going to sing this next song. I think you know it, okay?" Perry continued, gearing up to perform her 2008 hit single, Hot and Cold. Of that time in her life, she joked, "Mommy was a bit wild back then." Also in the crowd at Perry's Las Vegas show were celebrity fans including Celine Dion and Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan, who coordinated in black looks. Perry and Bloom have been together since 2016 and welcomed Daisy Dove, their only child, in 2020. The actor is also dad to son Flynn, 12, from his marriage to supermodel Miranda Kerr. "Everything that's supposed to fade away fades away, and a balance comes in," the singer said of her motherhood in a 2021 interview with People, adding that her daughter taught her the meaning of true love. "I never really, truly knew about unconditional love," she said. "Obviously, my mother has that for me, but I didn't really experience it in the first person until I had my child, and that was just a whole nother level." So we have some Oprah's favorite things. These are coziest gifts. Here's a couple ideas. Roam, R-O-A-M, fuzzy platform slides. These wedge platforms have a faux shearling upper with memory foam and a neoprene footbed for a custom and supportive fit that's like walking on a cloud. It's $185 at Amazon. Spanx Air Essentials top and pants. Oprah first tried these on for an Oprah Daily photo shoot and has been a fan ever since. They come in a lightweight fabric that's luxuriously soft and silky with four-way stretch so they never, ever feel constricting. $128 at Amazon. And the YGN T-shirt turban. This classic head wrap is lined in satin with a stretchy jersey outer, allowing recipients everywhere to protect their hair as they lounge. $28 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.